I'm Bert Cohen. Welcome to Portside. And the USA, where one of the things that we make here is weapons systems. They're great for the economy, aren't they? The military establishment is really said to be kind of the foundation of America's economy. We keep investing more and more and more dollars into the military establishment. But is that the best use of our tax dollars? And how possible might it be to make some changes? I'm very pleased to have with us on Portside Heidi Garrett Peltier, co-author of The U.S. Employment Effects of Military and Domestic Spending Priorities, an Updated Analysis. Heidi, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, as many people know, unemployment is at a 25-year high and is expected to remain into double digits well into 2010. President Obama has announced a White House jobs summit, and that's the beginning of recognition that the unemployment rate is really unacceptable. The measured rate is now 10.2%. But if you count people who have given up or who are involuntarily working part-time, the real rate is probably over 17%. And Larry Summers, one of President Obama's top economic advisors, said recently, "We designed the Recovery Act to ramp up overtime through 2010 and to make sure that the investments we made were important to the country's future." A spokesperson for Speaker Nancy Pelosi said recently, "We continue to look for opportunities to build on the recovery package and other actions Congress has taken to bolster the economy." But, you know, no one is talking about the effects of the military budget on the economy. Heidi, tell us about how this report came about and what it says about the military budget and the economy.
Sure. You know, as you mentioned earlier, the conventional wisdom is that military spending is good for the economy. And so we wanted to take a look at that and see, you know, how true it is and if there are other ways that we could be spending our tax dollars not only to create as many jobs as the military, but potentially even more jobs. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is true. We're spending billions of dollars on the military. Last year it was over $600 billion. And, you know, if we think about it, if we spend billions of dollars on anything, we're going to create jobs, whether we're building yachts or planting trees or, you know, as the famous British economist John Maynard Keynes said, if we, you know, hire people to dig holes and fill them back up again, we're going to be creating jobs. So basically, we wanted to look at military spending in relation to other types of spending that are of vital national importance. So areas like education, healthcare, and an area that is particularly important to me, which is clean energy. And Perry being short for the Political Economy Research Institute, here at Perry we've done a lot of work around clean energy, and we see this as a particularly promising area if we want to think about military conversion and providing jobs for people who are typically in military industries and employing them using similar skill sets, clean energy is certainly one way to go. And when we've looked at spending the same amount of money, let's say $1 billion in the military versus even doing something as simple as tax rebate checks, we would generate more employment through tax rebates. We would generate even more in clean energy. So, for example, $1 billion in the military creates close to 12,000 jobs, whereas that same $1 billion spent in clean energy would create over 17,000 jobs.
So it's a lot of jobs that we're talking about, and I'm certainly old enough to remember something we expected called the peace dividend, wherein the, when the many decade war on Vietnam finally ended in 1975, we expected a peace dividend. When the Cold War ended, we expected a peace dividend, and that was supposed to innate those two items in history, ending the war in Vietnam and ending the Cold War, were supposed to create, give us tremendous new opportunities to invest those dollars away from what had been spent, you know, on war situations, hundreds of billions of dollars of jobs. We were supposed to benefit from that. The nation was supposed to benefit from that. Whatever happened with that? Did military spending go down after the war in Vietnam ended? Did it go down after the Cold War ended?
It did go down a bit in comparison to the Cold War average, but generally our levels of, and I don't have the exact data for the late 80s or early 90s for how much we spent on the war, but recently I've seen some data that shows sort of the average Cold War spending was about $400 billion a year in today's dollars, and it went above that in times like Vietnam and in the first Gulf War. And certainly we're much higher than that now at over $600 billion a year. We're, 1.5 times the average spending that we were at for the Cold War. But, what happened, I think, is that we got out of conflict, but we didn't scale back on our military production in general, economy-wide. And, there are a lot of companies in the military-industrial complex that certainly fought hard to keep that sort of production going. And there was no concerted effort. There was no real strategy for conversion. And I think that's where we lost out on that peace dividend. The last one of the other reasons we started looking at this question recently, the first paper we wrote on this was 2 years ago, was that nothing had been published or written or studied about this since that discussion of the peace dividend in the early 90s. And there was this gap. And in that gap, basically, there was an opportunity for a conversion that was never that never materialized. And so if we want to think about conversion now, we need to make a much more concerted effort to make sure we do have this transition, and not just that we're scaling back military production, but that we're transferring it into other types of productive activities. And that's why the manufacturing of clean energy technologies would be one sort of logical segue. And if we think of it in terms of more of a positive transition rather than just a scaling back, I think we can seize that opportunity in a way that wasn't seized in the early 90s.
Well, we're talking on Portside with Heidi Garrett Peltier. I hope I pronounced that right.
You did.
Co-author of U.S. Employment Effects of Military and Domestic Spending Priorities. And it seems that we have been really addicted to military spending throughout the 20th century and now into the 21st century, that it's been taken as a given that the military budget is a cornerstone of the U.S. economy. Where this show is originating in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, there's the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, and the workers are always at risk, it's felt, and that there was the Military Base Closure Commission, which had recommended this particular military base be closed, and a convincing argument was made that, well, they make submarines, which are necessary for national security, and, well, you really can't cut that. So many jobs are dependent on that. I wonder, you know, the peace dividend time sort of came and went, and we didn't make the changes then. And, you know, the $600 billion plus military budget creates about 5 million jobs within the military and in civilian industries. Where is where are the politicians on this? Are they not talking about this? And you also, and that would also add into the what you were talking about is clean energy, cleaning up the air. Perhaps it might be necessary and appropriate to talk about redefining what national security is.
Well, I think that's very true. I was, interestingly, the timing of your show couldn't be more perfect. I was just at a peace conversion symposium this past weekend at the University of Connecticut. And one of the questions that was raised there, they had some Connecticut state legislators there on the panel, and one of the questions that was raised was, how do we overcome this gap? And the gap is between the public perception and the public opinion that we need to cut back on defense spending, and the sort of political willingness by politicians to actually do so. And how do we overcome that? If the public is saying we want, you know, we want to get out of Iraq, we want to get out of Afghanistan, we want to cut back our military spending, and the politicians should be doing what the public wants, why are they not? And, you know, in many cases, it's because there are these, you know, naval shipyards and military manufacturers in the districts of politicians who are making these decisions.
Well, I wonder how that can start to change. I mean, our member of Congress here is, I think, in line with probably our thinking on many different things. I don't believe she's in favor of expanding the war in Afghanistan. She was certainly against continuing the war in Iraq. And at the same time, you know, there's these particular jobs in the district. It's been talked about that, and talk about, I don't know about conversion, if the best word, but full use, full strategic use. For example, the shipyard here repairs submarines and refuels submarines. But there may be a national need for heavy industrial uses that are different, such as making train cars, passenger train cars, freight train cars, things like that. And that could make full use of the facility. And maybe an effort like that could go on. But again, I don't see any politicians willing to take that on, not just conversion, which is kind of scary to people because there are so many jobs dependent on it, but actually just phasing it into not just military, but additional use as well. Is that going on anywhere in the country that you know of?
If it is, you know, those are not discussions that I've been privy to. I have not heard about this happening, that really massive retooling, let's say, of plants that currently are building weapon systems or military-related vehicles that could instead be producing civilian, you know, the example you gave was great, mass transportation vehicles, electric buses, freight rail cars, and so on. And, you know, I think without some sort of broad pressure from the public to do that, I don't know if the incentive is there for a politician to sort of step forward and say, you know, we are willing to engage in this experiment, because it is at this point, I think, viewed as experimental. We don't know what the outcome will be. We can sort of make an educated guess, but we don't know. And I think the fear of losing jobs that aren't going to be replaced is what keeps people from sort of taking that step forward, even if there's a high likelihood that the outcome could be positive on the side of jobs. I think the uncertainty is what's keeping people from actually making that step.
Right, the uncertainty, fear. Fear is such a powerful political force, unfortunately, to make those changes. We're talking with Heidi Garrett-Peltier of the Political Economy Research Institute, which is out of the UMass Amherst, I believe. And this research that you did, the new report, how was the research done? How many, were there a lot of people involved? And who funded this research? And finally, what do you expect to be done with the findings?
Well, we're sort of a small operation here, just a few of us. The research for this paper was actually done exclusively by Bob Polin and I. Robert Polin is the co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute, and I am a research fellow here. And 2 years ago, we were approached by someone from the Institute for Policy Studies in D.C.
Uh-huh.
And they had traditionally done some work around these questions of military spending and military conversion, and they enlisted us to write a report looking at military versus alternative spending. So we initially wrote a report 2 years ago. It came out in 2007, and then we updated it this year with some newer data. And also, the 2007 report did not include any spending for clean energy as a category, and that was something we were able to incorporate into this newer version because we've done a lot of work on clean energy in the last couple of years.
Well, what are the things that you look at, I think, that can put this in ways that the people can, I think, readily understand? People, I think, get what $1 billion is. That's $1,000 million, which is still staggering to me as it is. So,
right.
So you look at the relative employment impacts of spending $1 billion on domestic priorities. Say you spent $1 billion on the military, and the military budget is about $675 billion a year,
right,
which is just beyond anybody's capability of to understand, really. So if you spend $1 billion on maintaining weapon systems, on building new weapon systems, maybe I could back up a little bit and just ask, you know, once the military spending is done, if we look at adding value to the economy, I wonder about, you know, once a military project is done, do those dollars invested, aside from paying wages and buying, you know, the parts and the electrical wires and the plastic, et cetera, the raw materials, once that done and the people there are finished making that, do they just stop buying, you know, groceries and having that ripple effect from those dollars being spent? And I wonder how, you know, once a project is done, is that it? Does it continue to add value to the local economy? And perhaps you could compare that to other projects that your report looked at.
Sure. Well, you know, what you talk about with the ripple effect is there are multiple levels of job creation, of course. So we use an input-output model, which looks at all of these linkages throughout the economy. So if a business is buying goods and services from other businesses throughout the economy, when the original business, let's use the example of a construction company, if a construction company gets an order, then they're spending it for the construction company, and it hires its own workers, and it's also buying lumber and hardware, and workers as a result are employed in the lumber and hardware companies. So those are what we call the indirect workers. And then when all of those workers, the construction workers, the lumber workers, the hardware workers, when they are earning their paycheck and going out and spending it, that creates what we call induced effect. So those are the jobs in food and retail and housing and so on. And so when we compare the military spending to other types of spending, like clean energy and education, we are using this economy-wide approach with this input-output model. So we see not only the direct effects of the employment, but also the indirect and the induced effects. And it's true for any of these categories, military or otherwise. you know, once the spending runs out, once the project ends, if a worker is no longer paid wages, they don't have those wages to go out and spend on food or clothing and so on and create those jobs once the project is finished and the, let's say, the submarine building company is not buying steel from a steel company, that will reduce the demand for the steel product and the steel workers. And, you know, the same is true for education and healthcare and so on. If we reduce our spending in, you know, if we lay off some teachers through educational budget cuts, those teachers are going to have reduced wages or no wages, and their spending is also going to decrease and create job losses in other sectors. And, you know, that's one thing that we're seeing with this unemployment rate, which is now, you know, officially the most conservative unemployment rate is above 10%, and that is a result of these ripple effects. So, you know, as a military project winds down, the amount of the job loss will certainly be contingent upon whether the plant closes completely or whether they scale back production and lay off some workers. But certainly military spending is prone to this sort of boom and bust cycle with increases in spending at wartime and decreases in spending in peacetime. And if we think about transitioning to a higher level of, let's say, a lower level of military spending and a higher level of something like clean energy spending, that does not need to be a boom and bust cycle, but that could be essentially the work of at least a generation and ramping up our production of solar and wind and weatherizing buildings and expanding our mass transportation system and so on. This is not something that is going to be cyclical or responsive to increases in war spending and so on. So in terms of just thinking about economic stability going forward, clean energy, healthcare, education, these are all much more stable areas for domestic spending than something like the military, which will have flux in the production and in the employment of those military workers.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talked before about John Maynard Keynes. I'd like to see a bumper sticker, bring back Keynes, because he really knew his stuff, I think. And that the workers at military-related jobs, I don't think they, you know, it matters that much what they're doing as long as they're doing something. So he talked about, you know, digging a hole, filling it back in. It's just a job of some sort. And I wonder if military could be said, military spending, overspending could be a kind of welfare in a way, sort of addicted that people can get and the economy of an area can get addicted to, not necessarily productive use of our public capital. I wonder if that, you know, because what they're making doesn't necessarily matter as long as some sort of widget or another, just making something. Whereas if you say clean energy, now there's something different and much more than just widgets, whether or not they're useful. I mean, there's certainly, it would be interesting to see what percentage of the military budget, the things that we've bought so far, are just basically sitting in a warehouse somewhere gathering dust, you know, once they're done. You know, hopefully not all the weapons that we've made are all being used. They don't all have to be used, hopefully. And there's certainly, you know, the age-old factor of cost overruns that are kind of built in there, and the power of the contractors, you know, that they just keep the American society, our tax dollars, kind of addicted to this not necessarily productive use of capital. But compare that to, as you say, clean energy, $1 billion spent on the military. What could $1 billion on clean energy create in terms of jobs?
Well, looking at exactly that figure, $1 billion, according to our estimates, that creates about 11,800, so almost 12,000 jobs in the military, and a little over 17,000 jobs through clean energy. So the way we've defined clean energy is building weatherization, so insulating, replacing windows, caulking, and so on. So weatherizing homes and public buildings, expanding our transportation infrastructure, expanding our electrical infrastructure and moving towards smart grid technology. So there are lots of energy efficiencies to be achieved there. And then wind, solar, and biomass. So by investing the same $1 billion in those energy areas as opposed to the military, we'd create 17,000 jobs instead of about 12,000 jobs, so about 1.5 times as many jobs per dollar of spending. And the interesting thing is that a lot of these jobs are in occupations that are present in the military-industrial businesses. So, mechanics, welders, electricians, machinists, steel workers, and so on. There would need to be some retraining involved, but a lot of the occupations are actually occupations that already exist in these military firms or military-oriented businesses. And so by spending the same amount of money, not only by spending it in clean energy, not only are we employing people who are already employed in the military and putting people to work who are currently unemployed, but as you say, we're also investing in something productive. We're investing in something that we need to be building. Right now, a lot of our solar and wind equipment is imported from overseas. There are many components that we have the skills and knowledge to be able to manufacture right here in the U.S., and we're not doing so. So there's an enormous capacity for us to move into manufacturing some of these technologies that we're currently importing and putting people back to work in the manufacturing sector and also in all the related sectors, in the construction sector, installing solar panels and putting up wind turbines, weatherizing homes and so on, all the technical jobs that go along with this, the scientific and engineering jobs, the research. It's really a whole host of occupations.
Yeah, tremendous ripple effect. There's the people who install it, plumbers, heating technicians, hot, heating, ventilating, air conditioning people.
Right.
You could plug in very easily. We're talking on Portside with Heidi Garrett Peltier, economist at the Political Economy Research Institute, about military spending and is it really the best for our national security? And I can't imagine how many weapon systems have become obsolete and are just taking up space. And, they build one, big gizmo, multi-billion dollar gizmo. It sits on the shelf. And then the community where it's built just wait for some other thing to come down the line, whatever the heck it could be that that military facility might be used for. And, there's a lot of talk on the hard right these days about Obama being some sort of a socialist. But, it strikes me that, in a way, these military jobs, they're not really market-driven. They're certainly not the free market that is creating these multi-billion dollar gizmos. It's kind of socialism for one sector of the economy. What's your reaction to that observation?
I hadn't put it in those terms before, but that does make a lot of sense. Military spending over the last 8 years or so, over the course of the Bush presidency, grew much faster than the rest of the economy. We might think about it as you mentioned earlier, sort of a corporate welfare.
Yeah.
A lot of these firms that have contracts have cost-plus pricing, so they, many times don't even need to bid for the contract, and so they're not producing as efficiently as they might if they faced competition for these contracts and if they were forced to produce, at the least cost or, highest quality per dollar sort of production, and that's not the constraints placed upon them. And so, I think that's an interesting take. Think about it as socialism in the military sector.
Yeah, well, I, if they want to talk about free market, well, you know, I noticed you didn't mention in terms of the definition of clean energy, nuclear power, because the free market would not sustain that. It's based on kind of a socialistic support for nuclear power. If its insurance were not underwritten by we the people, it wouldn't exist. If it had to go out and get insurance on its own and just be within the free market like every other energy source, whereas the energy sources you're talking about, solar, wind, and retrofitting old buildings, those are in fact sustainable, and the market could maintain that. You know, and here we have the president now talking about holding a jobs summit fairly soon. Is there, what talk is there about looking at conversion, at making full use of these now exclusively military facilities? Is there any of that at all? Or are they just, I mean, it seems very odd that they should be talking about, we need jobs. My goodness, we certainly need jobs. We've been shipping over our jobs overseas for decades, and it's certainly gotten worse under the Bush administration. But as you talk about clean energy, education, other real national needs could be met by, you know, using tax dollars. And do you see that being talked about when the jobs summit comes up? Is somebody there going to bring it to the table?
I don't know, but frankly, I would doubt it. I think it's a conversation that we need to be having, but I don't think it's being had. I do think, you know, clean energy is finally on the table as a matter of national priority, and I think it's wonderful that the Obama administration is putting a lot of weight behind, you know, developing clean energy and trying to think about clean energy as a job solution, which I certainly think it is, or at least a solution to part of the problem. But I don't think that there are any serious discussions, and I doubt that there will be at the job summit on this issue of conversion.
And it could be, I would think.
And it certainly could be, yes. It
certainly should be, I would think. And at the conclusion of the report that you co-authored, it says there's a great deal at stake as policymakers and voters establish public policy spending priorities. So we talk about clean energy and the jobs that could be created there. What other priorities did you look at, you know, spending $1 billion in military versus clean energy? I guess you looked at healthcare and education as well. What might $1 billion buy in healthcare and in education?
Well, in healthcare, $1 billion buys a little bit more in terms of employment. Actually, in both healthcare and employment and education, we get even more jobs per dollar than we do in clean energy or than in the military. So as I said earlier, it's about 12,000 in the military per $1 billion of spending, about 17,000 through clean energy, and then healthcare is close to 20,000, and education is 29,000. So education is by far the biggest bang for the buck in terms of number of jobs per dollar spent. And that's mainly because education is a very labor-intensive industry. Most of every dollar spent goes directly into wages for teachers. It's not a capital-intensive industry. You know, it's not a shipbuilding company that would employ, you know, lots of machinery in addition to its workers. So a dollar of public investment or public spending certainly goes farther in terms of hiring workers when we spend it in education than if we spend it in any other sector. Education is by far the most jobs per dollar, followed by healthcare and then followed by clean energy. And military spending lags behind all of those. And the main issue for all of those is the labor intensity, that all of those sectors are more labor intensive than the military. And there's also the issue of domestic content. So of every dollar spent, how much of that dollar stays within the U.S. versus being used, either being spent abroad or being used to buy imports? And, you know, for education, the domestic content is very high.
Yes.
I don't happen to know off the top of my mind what the what the percentage is, but it's in the upper 90s for sure of the amount, 90-something percent of every dollar spent on education stays in the U.S. Whereas, you know, with military spending, not only are we buying imports for the production, but we're the military personnel themselves are spending a chunk of their income outside of the country. So
true,
that also contributes to this job effect.
And if we are interested in jobs, and I think we are interested in jobs, as you mentioned, there's capital-intensive jobs and labor-intensive jobs. Is military spending, I wonder how it boils down, like as a percentage of every dollar spent, how much is capital-intensive versus how much is labor-intensive? Obviously, teaching and energy can be very labor-intensive and keep the production here, actually start making stuff here in the United States. But military spending, I wonder where that fits in terms of capital intensiveness.
I don't actually have the statistics on that. I know, you know, for sure it's going to be more capital intensive than something like education or even healthcare. In relation to clean energy, which has a lot of manufacturing, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how the manufacturing of clean energy compares to the manufacturing in the military. Some military manufacturing is very capital intensive, and others, right. You know, when you're installing intricate electrical equipment or an electronic equipment into a bomber, that's a labor intensive process. So how military spending compares to clean energy in terms of capital or labor intensiveness, I couldn't say, but there are certainly sections of clean energy, categories of clean energy spending that are very labor-intensive, particularly weatherization. So weatherizing buildings and homes by insulating attics, replacing windows, those kinds of activities are very labor-intensive. And the construction industry, in general, about 96% of spending on construction for weatherization projects, about 96% of that is domestic spending.
It's interesting.
In comparison, for wind and solar, it's about 80% domestic spending. So there's certainly a big opportunity there to increase the domestic spending in wind and solar by manufacturing more of our wind and solar components right here in the States.
And these critics would always say of public works jobs that, oh, it's just make work. You know, it's just creating jobs to, as Keynes may have said, digging a ditch and filling it in again. But spending on clean energy actually does something. It creates the capability of building new things here in the United States. And one of the things that's frustrated, I think, a lot of Americans is that what do we make here? Everything you buy is made, it seems, in China or, you know, Asia somewhere, largely because the larger corporations have this kind of race to the bottom and go where they can pay the least and have the fewest environmental standards that they have to meet. So, of course, they go to places where there's fewer environmental standards and they can pay less. But that's one of the, I would think, beauties of the clean energy industry is that this could inspire American ingenuity, you know, and have real entrepreneurs out there creating new things that can save energy and be very, very useful for energy, like new battery technology and solar hot water collectors and updating photovoltaic capability. But that might be called by its critics make work jobs, whereas it strikes me how hypocritical it may be to be making weapon systems that we know we're never going to use. I mean, now we're fighting wars against the people who bring us terrorism. So what do we need giant ships for? If, you know, are we still building weapon systems to fight the Soviet Union, which went out of business 20 years ago? I heard that there's some like $63 billion spent each year on obsolete weapons. And certainly the argument you must have thought of, can diversion of what's now military welfare be reallocated without risking the national defense? I mean, certainly you don't want to put the nation at risk in terms of not being ready for attacks, although all that money didn't seem to do a lot of good on 9/11. We were just wide open there. But can how would you answer the question of can diversions be made in what's now military spending without risk to our national defense?
Well, you know, I think we can look at our economic security and our energy security as components of our national security. And, you know, if we think about how vulnerable our electrical system is right now, our electric grid, it's very centralized, it's overburdened, it's vulnerable, you know, both just to outages in the sort of normal course of operations, and it's vulnerable to attack. It's very centralized. As we move to a more distributed power system where we have more wind turbines and solar panels plugging into the grid, and as we move to more smart grid technology where we can better manage the demand and supply of technology through essentially information technology, as we move to a more distributed and a more resilient system, that increases our national security as well. So we can think about energy infrastructure investments as meeting a national security goal. That's one example I would give. Another I would give is, with climate change, we are becoming more vulnerable to extreme weather events. And if we look at the coastal property, I'm sorry I don't have the figures for New Hampshire, but if we look at the coastal property values, at least as of a couple years ago, of Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, the coastal property values were about $3 trillion. Now, all of those areas are very vulnerable to extreme weather events, especially flooding and hurricanes.
Right.
And investments in clean energy can help to mitigate against climate change, can help to protect us against the possibility of some of these extreme weather events. So, you know, in terms of national security and economic security, if we're worried about attacks to New York, we need to be at least as worried about climate attacks on New York as attacks by an outside power. So, you know, I think that investing in clean energy is contributing to the goals of our national security.
Well, certainly our addiction to foreign oil is a big part of the problem, and I've heard.
Oh, of course, and I didn't even mention that. Yeah, I mean, more than half of our oil is imported right now. Not all of it from the Middle East, but certainly a large chunk from the Middle East. As we wean ourselves of our dependency on foreign oil, we also contribute to our national security for sure.
Yeah, we are talking, Bert Cohen here on Portside with Heidi Garrett Peltier, an economist at the Political Economy Research Institute out of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and about how our military dollars are being spent, if it really increases our national security. And one thing that I found fascinating and almost amusing was that we ship so many jobs overseas in the military. There was a good possibility that new submarines could be made by the Chinese. And, you know, isn't that, they are a huge new superpower, and what is national security if not having jobs here, people able to go to work building and servicing things that we need? Whereas if our tax dollars are just going to, whoever can build military weapon systems that we don't, that don't really do anything, how it's like through the looking glass stuff. It just seems so very odd to be doing that in the name of national security. And, one of the things, getting back to your interest in clean energy, Van Jones was hired by the Obama administration to kind of reorder spending and to have our tax dollars be used to create jobs that were very, very meaningful for people where the jobs are needed in the inner cities, creating green jobs. He was let go by this administration. The Glenn Beck hard right leaned on him and Obama bent and threw Van Jones under a bus, as it were. And I wonder how we can get to those priorities. It must be frustrating for you researchers there to look at these numbers and to see, hey, you know, spending $1 billion on clean energy, on education, transportation, and education makes a lot more sense. But it doesn't seem to be. Here we have a new administration that talked about this stuff, and yet how much is it happening? Do you know something that I don't know, that maybe they really are doing this stuff?
Oh, I wish I did. You know, one thing I can say was you mentioned much earlier in the program the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus bill from back in February. And if we look at all the parts of the stimulus bill, that did include about $100 billion for various energy projects and environmental projects. So, you know, $100 billion, that's nearly an eighth of the stimulus bill. So based on that, it does appear that there is a priority in the administration to fund energy. And a large part of that type of funding was through tax credits and economic incentives that would leverage additional investment in the private sector. So I know one of the criticisms that people will make of the stimulus bill is it was just handouts, but a lot of the way at least the energy spending was structured was not only direct public investment in research and upgrading government fleets of vehicles and so on, but also providing incentives for the private sector to invest in clean energy. And so it does appear that there is that political willingness from the administration, but I think we need much more. When we look at the estimates of temperature rises and extreme weather events and all of the climate change projections just from here to 2050 and the massive amount of reduction we need in fossil fuel use and investment in clean energy, both from the public sector and the private sector, we need to be doing much more. The administration needs to be doing much more. So I'm encouraged that they're taking steps in the right direction, but they need to be leaps, not steps.
And I would think that they need to hear from the public. I mean, we hire this government to work for us, really. It's not the other way around. And I would think that what you're providing here in this new report, again, is called the U.S. Employment Effects of Military and Domestic Spending Priorities, is that this could be a tool that citizens could use to say to their members of Congress and U.S. senators, hey, what about this? So I assume that's one of the intents of this the report that you worked on.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I wouldn't want to think that economics are the beginning and the end of telling a story and making a case for something, but I do think they're a useful tool. Certainly the main reason that we wrote this report and other reports like it is to put these tools in the hands of people who are fighting for these changes, who are pushing for reductions in military spending and increases in spending in health, education, and clean energy, that they can basically use this as a tool to say, you know, look at the jobs, look at the numbers. We can do better if we make this transition. Certainly this report is not a blueprint. It's not a map on, showing us how we get from here to there. But it helps support the argument using data directly from the U.S. government. This is we generated these numbers using data from the Department of Commerce, from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the BEA. And so using, their own data and constructing this report, we hope that people can use it to fight, in their congressional district, to push their congressman to support a transition from military spending to other types of spending that are of national importance.
And members of Congress certainly do listen to their constituents. And, you know, I wonder about this. There's so many towns that have grown up around military facilities, towns that depend on military spending, you know, not just the obvious pizza and beer, but retailers, grocers, suppliers, mechanics. What can you tell these town government people and local businesses, you know, why wouldn't they want to fight as hard as they can to hold on to their dependence on military facilities? And it's a tough sell for people like that, I would think.
Yeah, it certainly is a tough sell for people who's, you know, in their own communities, they have, you know, sometimes hundreds of jobs, if not thousands of jobs, dependent on military spending. So it is, you know, it's an incredible challenge to say reduce military spending to your district. But at the same time, if we can look at, and I'll keep using this example of clean energy, we need to move to a more clean energy system, and I think we will. It's just a matter of when. And if we kind of sit back and just hang on to our military-related jobs and let others manage the transition to clean energy and let, you know, the Chinese, Japanese, Germans continue to produce most of our clean energy technologies, and we don't take an active role in securing some of that manufacturing base, you know, we're going to lose out in the long term. And so, you know, I think it's a struggle. It is a challenge to say, well, in the short term it might be difficult, but in the long term we'll benefit. You know, people are concerned with their paychecks this week, next year. It's hard to take the sort of more long-term approach. And so...
But we have to do it sometime.
And if we don't take an active role in it, others will.
That's right. You know? And there's all kinds of progress being made in terms of clean energy that is happening, you know, with battery technology and, as I said, photovoltaics and who knows what, even for, I understand there's sort of a kite possibility for shipping huge, huge ships, you know, that carry tremendous amount of freight. There are some computer-driven kites that can catch the wind energy and help move that stuff. Why shouldn't the U.S. be making that stuff? And isn't it in our taxpayer interest to do that, to invest in that area? And, you know, it's often said that the Pentagon, the military budget, is often a stimulus to important technical innovations, not just Tang back in the 60s when they needed dry vitamin C drinks. But the internet, I believe, comes out of military spending. So isn't this then a useful investment in our national economy?
Yes. Well, you know, in terms of if we just look at our R&D dollars, our research and development dollars in the public budget, they have been heavily, heavily skewed towards researching fossil fuels and nuclear energy. And really, there's no reason why they should be as skewed towards those sectors and away from clean energy. I think even striking more of a balance towards, you know, decreasing our R&D dollars on fossil fuels and nuclear and increasing our R&D spending in clean energy will certainly stimulate American innovation with American dollars and American jobs. And ideally, you know, provide more of a greater supply of ideas that can then lead to more manufacturing of these clean energy technologies. You know, there are multiple ways to meet our energy challenges. And, you know, you mentioned one sort of radical approach with kites and shipping. But, you know, there are so many that...
That we could be doing here.
That we could be doing, both with public dollars and private dollars.
And it's interesting, so many critics of the idea of using public tax dollars for the public good, and yet look what came out of, you know, the Great Depression, the WPA, and all the wonderful things that we still depend on in our economy. If we had something like that, how beneficial that could be. Do you see much of a difference in terms of spending for the priorities that you think that the report indicates would be better for our economy? Is there a big change under Obama than under George W. Bush?
That's a good question, actually. I have not taken a look at, for example, healthcare and education funding pre and post Obama. I haven't taken a look at how that has changed. You know, with clean energy spending, as I mentioned, it was a big component of the stimulus package. So right. In terms of just dollars spent on clean energy, I'm sure it would be higher under the Obama administration than the Bush administration. But that's, at this point, that would be maybe an educated guess. I haven't actually looked at that data.
Well, as we get close to the end of the hour, what can people do? You know, you can talk about diverting a few billion here or there, but actually making it happen. Boy, that's the tough part. What can people do if people are interested in getting a hold of this this report and making best use of the tools that you provide? You got any suggestions?
Well, in terms of getting a hold of the report, I would suggest to go to our website, which is PERI, P-E-R-I, short for Political Economy Research Institute, .umass.edu. And you can find the report there along with reports on clean energy. So that's in terms of getting a hold of the report. And, you know, I think the next step, which is a big step, is to form a broad coalition of stakeholders, really, of people who have something at stake in either losing military jobs or gaining a more sustainable energy system and clean energy jobs and healthcare and education jobs. And so, you know, I think we need to build our movement and find allies in places that might not be, that might not initially seem like likely places. So, for example, the machinists and metal workers and so on that are in the military industry right now, they would have a stake in transitioning to clean energy. They could maintain their jobs and be trained in producing clean energy manufactured goods instead of military manufactured goods. So I think, you know, in terms of what people can do with this going forward, anything you would normally do for, you know, to be involved in the political process, put pressure on your representatives and your congressmen and, you know, build a broad base of support for this notion of military conversion and conversion into a cleaner energy economy.
Well, thank you very much, Heidi Garrett Peltier with the PERI Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts. Thanks very much for being with us on Portside today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Was killed.